Mexico City for 1968, where the political tension at home and abroad is as high as the altitude the athletes faced competing here. Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists, Fosbury flopped, Bob blasted the record books, and a Swede drinks beer. Welcome to the Games of the 19th Olympipod.
There will be some skeptics in the audience who will say, didn't you say that before? Have we not been on this dance? Has this not been a synchronized swim of, well, I didn't plan that out.
Despair.
What would begin with it? No, well, that doesn't begin with S.
a synchronized swim of sycophancy.
Has this not been a synchronized swim of sycophancy? I don't know, Chris. I don't know. Yeah, look, sure, here we are. We did say about this time last year that we were having our big relaunch. Mm-hmm. I did spend a lot of time about 10 months ago wandering the streets of Gothenburg, persuading everyone and anyone to subscribe to the Olympipod because of our impending triumphant return. But look, here we are. It is coming back, and we're this time we believe we are going to be back for good.
There's a key difference this time, Ruth, and that is Paris 2024 is rapidly approaching. Last time we had a good year and a half to go. This time we have half a year to go. So I feel like we're going to be on the ball this time because we literally have no other choice.
No, we have no other choice. And also, Chris, like, everyone is just so desperate for us to come back. You know, the word on the street is that people have just not been able to survive without their Olympipod. To give you an example, Chris, I went on to Reddit and I decided to search Olympipod. And we have had people slash a person, PlantMom23 specifically, who recommended us a good year ago and said, if you like an Olympic history podcast with very full cast energy, Olympipod. And she gave that recommendation, or he, with full faith. And we never really backed that up. So thank you, PlantMom23. We are back now, and hopefully all the people that you recommended us to on Reddit will now also hear our voices, our melodious voices.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing is Olympipod is quite timeless, you know, and people have continued to download and listen throughout this time because, you know, we don't really need to be here, but at a certain point, we've got to give the people what they don't know they want yet. The Danish national broadcaster needs an Olympic podcast to recommend this summer, and we're ready to be that again.
Yeah, and specifically, if we're talking about the Danish national broadcaster, they need someone to recommend above their own Olympic podcasts, and we fit into that mold just so well. So yes, we are back. We have all aspirations. We are like the Pierre de Coubertins of podcasting. Mm-hmm. We have dreams. We may cheat in some of the artistic categories later, but look, we're going to do our best, and we may hate women.
Wow!
Sorry, that was my Pierre de Coubertin. That was my Pierre de Coubertin coming out.
What a promise to make. So, shall we dive a little bit into the 1968 Summer Olympics, Ruth?
Yeah, we should. And I do feel that we do need to make a little bit of a comment about not so much the 1968 Olympics, but the 1968 Olympipod. Mm. Because this is not actually the first time we're recording this episode, is it, Christopher?
It isn't. The first time we recorded this was in March 2023, and it slipped through the cracks, I guess. Life happened, you know? Life happened, right? Ruth?
Yes, Christopher, life happened. Yes. Yeah, so it's very much this kind of thing of if an Olympipod is recorded and nobody hears it, did it ever happen? I would very much say that yes, it did. And I was more prepared for 72 than I am for 68. We're still going to do 68. We're still going to do 68. But to me,
that's how it works.
68 canonically has already happened. And the fact that the listeners have not listened to it is more a reflection on them than on me. And I just, look, we're back. We will re-record this. Is it going to be a classic? Obviously. But will I be informed? I suppose no less than any other Olympopod. But yes, this is our second attempt at 1968. The first one, I will just say, it was an absolute cracker. Like, if that recording could have survived everything, it would have gone down in the history books. And I hope that in the future, you know, we do actually have a secret recording somewhere of an a pre-Olympopod, of an ancient Olympopod of the Greek. Chris, is that has that also come into 1968 territory? Oh, no,
that exists, but like that was our first attempt of recording something together. And as you know, Ruth, as we both know, we've done other podcasts before. The other one I do, the Uninformed Handball Hour, at its 233rd official episode today, I would be unwilling to go back and listen to the first recording we did in September 2017. And I think the first recording we did of the pre-Olympopod in summer of 2020, I may also be unwilling to revisit, but maybe I will at some point, and then maybe it will be shared with the world. But I have to say, I mean, you are a pro at this, and you know, we've gone 7.5 minutes so far of recording without mentioning anything about the current Olympic Games we're covering. So I think, you know, if in terms of time filling, we're doing very well so far. I know what you're up to, Ruth. So I just look forward to your take on the political situation in Mexico and the build-up to the Games.
Well, Chris, you are right. We will start talking about the Olympics very soon, but I do want to just give the listeners a bit of an update, which is that it's very cold and stormy where we're... Well, I say where we are. You're in Munich, I'm in Clonmel, and it has been icy and it has been stormy and it has been all of the likes. And I am coming into this Olympopod with an injury. So I just want people to be prepared for that. I slipped on the ice and I took the skin off my knee.
Oui.
Yeah. But such is my dedication to the Olympopod and to the Olympics that I am going to soldier through. So I'm going to put that onto the record, and let's talk about the politics, Chris, of Mexico, 1968.
Yeah, let's try. Well, let's give a little bit of background to the games itself rather than right into the politics of it. Mexico City was awarded the games all the way back in October 1959, and they beat out bids from Buenos Aires, Lyon, and classic runners-up Detroit.
Ah.
The Motor City that never quite got the games. Not yet, anyway. The 1968 games were the first to have the Olympic flame lit in Olympia and then transported all the way to the host city. An ambitious one to begin with, going all the way from Greece to Mexico City. And it was the first time we had full live global television coverage as well. But all that kind of pales in comparison to the political situation. The 1968 Games began 10 days after the Mexican army had massacred protesters in the Plaza de las Tres Culturas in Mexico City. Calls for the Games to be postponed fell on deaf ears as the IOC and the organizers released I guess you could call it a self-absorbed statement to justify going ahead while there were still bodies from the massacre laying in the morgues, saying none of the demonstrations or violence has at any times been directed against the Olympic Games, it said. We have been assured that nothing will interfere with the peaceful entrance of the Olympic flame into the stadium, because that's all that matters. As guests of Mexico, we have full confidence that the Mexican people, universally known for their sportsmanship and great hospitality, will join participants and spectators in celebrating the games, a veritable oasis in a troubled world. Yes.
Do you know what? The Olympics has always been apolitical, famously. Like, I mean, that's why our podcast has never had any dips or dives.
Bingo.
It's funny listening to you talk about all that. It reminds me of when we recorded this 10 months ago. I'm remembering facts. So that's great. That's great for the next 40 minutes or so. Yeah.
Do you wish to expand on any of these facts or just the, yes, oh, I remember now.
Anyway, yeah, not ideal.
I'm pretty sure this is hilarious to us and nobody else. Let's see. Only time will tell.
Listen, Chris, the listeners, they are a special breed. Anyway.
They are.
Look, I guess what the IOC are saying, what is 400 lives when compared to the commercial behemoth that is the Olympic Games? Now, I imagine the families of the victims would have had a very different opinion than that of the IOC. But as you mentioned, Chris, the IOC stated, this is a civil matter and nothing to do with the Olympic movement, giving us on the Olympipod permission not to speak on it further. But look, I do wonder though, if after they released that statement on the deadly pre-game kerfuffles, did they think to themselves, God, that's great now. All the politics out of the way for 4 years. Nothing else will happen at these games Absolutely. That will cause a massive international outcry, right? But look, Chris, it was a beautiful Olympics.
It was. It was a beautiful Olympics. I have some more things to kind of counter that statement on the way.
You still want to talk about the Mexican government massacring the students?
No, but you know, there are other things such as the boycott of African countries, including Ghana, Senegal and Sudan, because in protest of the IOC refusal to ban South Africa from the games due to its system of apartheid. And, there was the Black Power salute, which is probably the strongest image that comes from these games. And I think we should probably start there in terms of the sporting story, shall we?
Okay, go for it, Chris. I mean, I'm going to be honest, my stories... Anyway, so look, you start. You start, Chris, with the iconic stories.
Okay. We could go for the... iconography, that's an iconic story, so to speak, and quite beautiful as well, the design, but we'll talk about that later. The Black Power salute. So during the medal ceremony for the 2000 during the medal ceremony for the 200 meter race, African-American sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists in a Black Power salute while the national anthem played, and safe to say this caused plenty of controversy and eventually led to their suspension from the US team. Smith and Carlos protested in their protest was a real powerful and, unsurprisingly, controversial moment in both sports and civil rights history. It was a response to the ongoing struggle for racial equality in the United States, and particularly in the aftermath of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. earlier in 1968. Tommy Smith won the race, breaking the world record for 200 meters in 19.83 seconds. John Carlos got bronze, and in the middle was an Aussie, Peter Norman, who had a role to play as well. Smith and Carlos, during the ceremony, each wore a black glove and raised a clenched fist in a Black Power salute, a symbol of solidarity with the movement that was emerging back at home at the time. And Tommy Smith said, "We were just human beings who saw a need to bring attention to the inequality in our country." And John Carlos saying, "It wasn't a gesture of hate. It was a gesture of frustration. We knew that we were going to go down for this, but what we were going to do was greater than any athletic feat." And he was right. Immediately, it was met with a huge controversy and outrage, particularly from conservative politicians who saw the gesture as disrespectful and unpatriotic. The IOC also stuck their nose in, condemned their actions, and expelled them from the US team. They got plenty of backlash and criticism when they came back, including death threats due to being unpatriotic. And it also had a huge economic effect. The repercussions saw both of them struggling to find work afterwards. In the middle was Norman, who wore an American human rights badge as support to them on the podium. And in response, Norman was dropped because of that as punishment in 1972. But over time, of course, their protest has come to be recognized as a huge moment in sports and civil rights. In 1999, both of them were inducted finally into the US Olympic Hall of Fame. And they were given the Arthur Ashe Courage Award at the ESPY Awards in 2005. They have a statue at San Jose State University erected in 2016, where they both attended university and trained.
And when Norman died, which was only in 2006, both Smith and Carlos were pallbearers at his funeral.
Yeah.
It meant so much that the other podium member did support them, that they remained firm friends throughout the rest of their lives.
Yeah, yeah. It was beautiful. And I think he said as well, I mean, there was nothing. He's just, there was nothing else he would do in that situation. I think he knew he was also going to get a lot of shit for it afterwards, but still took it upon himself.
Yeah, he could have very easily just done nothing. Mm-hmm. A little like the IOC. But look, as you said, it was this truly iconic moment of this Olympic Games. But it does all really start being a bit of a theme. You know, the IOC and the USOC in particular, standing firm, saying that they are an apolitical movement, which is all very admirable, but then taking it to a place where essentially they're punishing athletes, who are, after all, humans, who do have political, civil and humanitarian concerns. And I don't know. I don't think we can look with anything other than, I suppose, condemnation when we see national and international bodies acting as they did at certain points in history. Like this moment.
So as...
And we'll see more of it. We'll see more of it over the next Olympopods.
Well, no. We certainly will. Now, as is tradition, Ruth, you will counter this with a hilarious story.
Well, Christopher, now, we all love a good doping. We do. Like, let's be honest. We like a good doping. And actually, 1968 was the first year after the new rules of the IOC came in. They'd just come in 1967, and we had our first disqualification. We had our first disqualification for doping.
We did indeed. Don't we continue?
No, I don't. So no, the honour...
Drugs are all yours, Ruth. I'm not going to like a raid in your parade.
Well, the honour goes to Swede Hans Gunnar Linjenvall, who had to return his bronze medal in the Team Modern Pentathlon event. And of all the events... to bring dishonor on the modern pentathlon. Are you serious? But anyway, that's where he did it.
Our beloved Team Modern Pentathlon.
Ah,
Pierre would be rolling in his grave if he's dead by that point.
Stop it, Chris. What he did do was he said he had had a couple of beers to calm his nerves before the pistol shooting event. I have a few issues, Chris. Okay, I have a few issues. First of all, alcohol wasn't on the banned substances list. But here we are. He did get disqualified. As a counter to that of, yes, alcohol wasn't on banned substances, I don't know if it's a good idea to have a few drinks before you shoot your pistol at the Olympics. Or ever. I would like to go on record, or ever. But, you know, on the one hand, was it illegal? No. Was it ill-advised? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to be shooting at people, you know? It's just a couple of beers.
It depends how many beers he has.
He said a couple, right?
he said some
beers. Between probably 3 and 7, you'd say.
I think I read somewhere 3, but that could have been someone looking at the sum and saying, well, that's 3 and 7. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. It was 3.
I mean, it reminds me of modern day pistol shooting, also known as darts. And it's very similar. I think there's a similar kind of set of skills associated with darts and pistol shooting. It's hand-eye coordination, it's accuracy, and it's holding something and projectiles. As we know, dart players traditionally do love, maybe they don't love it, maybe they just need some beers to calm their nerves so they can bang in those 180s. And Hans Gunnar Lilienvall was the founding father of this approach. But I know that narcotics and stimulants were among the banned, that's what they were looking for, right? Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of people who were arguing that the drug testing regime was inadequate, which is, I mean, you could probably make that argument today. So, of course, that's going to be the case for the very first one. And they only tested for some substances, so not even the powerful performance-enhancing drugs, which were already being used and continued to be used. But look, it's a battle that the IOC and others, WADA, if that's what they're still called, faces today. And I did meet a drug testing person quite recently, actually, at the end of the Women's Handball World Championship. And
how did you fare?
I didn't have to give a urine sample. We were just having a chat on the way to the airport. But thank you for asking. he's a fan of the handball podcast, which he uses to kind of stay informed in the sport. He's a British middle distance runner, and he's still quite active as well. He's based in Switzerland, and at one point finished fourth in the British Championship in 5,000 meters. So just missed out on qualification for a major championship. But I find it quite funny that he's responsible for drug testing, and that must be quite unnerving as he just like floats around the scene while also being a runner. And I didn't mention this podcast to him. Maybe at some point I will, because he might enjoy some of these early stories or these modern stories as we get closer and closer to Paris 2024. But maybe he'll pop up again.
Yeah, we have some absolutely stunning stories coming up. He might come on as a guest.
Maybe.
Yeah, because
I'll look into that.
Yeah.
So, anything else on our friend Hans Gunnar Lilienvall?
No, I mean, like, he seemed to lay low after that. He did not go, as far as I know, to 72. I don't know how I feel. And actually, do you know, Chris, we're going to go, when we go into 72, there's another few kind of drugs cases where I'm not sure how I feel. On the one hand, I just don't think you should be shooting guns after a few beers, even in the modern pentathlon team event. But at the same time, it wasn't, I don't really understand why his bronze medal got taken away. Like, do you think it was the IOC or is it the Swedish Olympic team that took it away?
Generally, it's been, I mean, we consider who's running the IOC at this point, probably the IOC.
But the thing is, the team didn't get it removed.
Ah, it was him personally.
It was him personally. So that's what I'm
wondering. So the
result
stands.
Sweden still won that event. Sorry, got bronze. They still got bronze at that event.
They won bronze.
They won bronze. And third is right after second and first.
Yep.
But yeah, so I kind of wonder, like, was it more of a morals thing?
Interesting.
I'm Googling. You have a Google face on you, Chris.
No, but I feel like we should have known the answer to that.
I think we did 10 months ago.
If personally stripped, that's all that matters. The team result stands.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ruth, there are names emerge from these games that stand the test of time. We already spoke about Smith and Carlos. Another one I want to talk about now is Dick Fosbury.
He's going to flop.
Oh, he flopped all right. And known back then for his unconventional Fosbury flop as he won the gold medal in 1968. And I really enjoy Dick Fosbury's story. Mm-hmm. He was not a good athlete, Ruth. He was not a good athlete.
Chris, big words.
Basically, He loved sport, but he wasn't really good at anything. Wasn't any good at American football. He was very tall, but he was terrible at basketball. He tried athletics, and he gave a go at a few different disciplines within athletics, and he found that the high jump was the one that he was the least useless at. He said himself that while he was in college, somebody bet me I couldn't clear a stuffed leather chair. Not only did I lose the bet, I also broke my hand in the crash landing. So, Ruth, where did it all go right, I hear you ask, behind your laughter? Well, at the time, there were two common methods of clearing the bar in the high jump. There was the scissors jump, where you first threw one leg over and then the other to the bar before landing on your feet. And the other one was called the Western Roll, which saw an athlete fling themselves over the bar face down, which was the technique used by Valeri Brumel, who won in 1964. So even though the technique had developed a fair bit, and already since 1936, there was a change in the rules that didn't require athletes to clear the bar leg first, nobody had figured out a better way to do it. It was just crawling along at its usual pace, but nobody coming up with anything special. But he tried it. Fosbury tried his new flop, and I'll go into how people described it in a moment or so. But he said, it looked a little bit weird when I tried this at first, but it felt so natural. And like all good ideas, you just wonder why nobody had thought of it before, he said. A couple of people claimed they had thought of it before. Most notably, the Canadian future world number one, Debbie Brill, who was developing what was known as the Brill Bend at around the same time. Mm. However, Fosbury got to the Olympics first. And so
I'm just kind of glad that like the people who did start developing this had suitable surnames to be able to alliterate it in English. Because, absolutely, you know, like, if your surname began with an S, what would you go for? What would you go for, Chris? If you were a spinman.
The
spinman.
The spinman.
No, that doesn't work.
The spinman spin.
No, because you have to spin then. You would have to spin. And then K as well.
The spinman like, slide? You kind of slide over the bar.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe a slink?
Slink. Mm. Yes. Well, thankfully, Ruth, we don't have to worry about this because that is not the history of this. but I'm pretty sure these things didn't come automatically to the witty journalists at the time. And I'm saying that with confidence because they had really difficulty in describing how they were doing it. The LA Times wrote that he goes over the bar like a guy being pushed out of a 30-story window. Sports Illustrated said he charges up from slightly to the left of center with a gait that may call to mind a two-legged camel.
Yes. Thank you for that very descriptive. Because yes, now mm-hmm. I immediately recognize a two-legged camel and how they do.
This is merely the run-up. But you're picturing something now, right?
Yes,
you're picturing
exactly,
it.
Yeah.
And as he flings himself over the bar for back first, he extends himself like a slightly apprehensive man lying back on a chaise longue that's too short for him. Oh, God. Dick himself described it as follows. I take off on my right or outside foot. Then I turn my back to the bar, arch my back over the bar, then kick my legs out to clear the bar. I guess he had a little bit more time to think about it in the end. So this came at quite an interesting time to release this properly at the Olympics. And the organizers clearly were not ready for this because the final lasted an entire 4 hours. Because the competition started at only 2 meters tall, 6 foot 6 inches for our North American, friends, and British and Irish, basically anyone who's not European. Every time the bar was raised, a committee of five men in blazers and hats spent several minutes measuring everything to make sure that everything was correct. And it was only after 42 jumps that the first person was eliminated. And by that point, the crowd had noticed that Dick Fosbury had this interesting approach. At first, they all laughed, of course, but then they started to cheer. And he says himself, psychologically, I extremely benefited from the actions of the crowd, who began to notice me. I felt their focus. I was able to channel that attention into a high level of intensity, raising but trying to control my level of excitement. And this is from a man who famously failed to do much training because he simply couldn't perform while nobody was watching him, which says a lot about him, I think. He ended up winning the title with his flop. And when he went back to the US, he went on the Johnny Carson show with Bill Cosby as one of the guests, who was once himself an aspiring high jumper, and Raquel Welsh. He was asked to demonstrate his technique on the show, but he slipped on the shiny studio floor and fell over. It was pretty much the last time anyone saw the Fosbury flop performed by himself. He drifted away from athletics. He did try to qualify for 1972, but he said he was mentally exhausted. Too much attention. People put me on a pedestal and kept me there. I didn't want to be there. I received my medal and wanted to be back in the ground with everyone else. The technique took on.
It's a bit like that. If you want to be like, if you want your feet on the ground, don't go into high jump.
Hey, well, he raises up, picks up his medal, and then lands on his back, and then gets on his feet again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
But yeah, I like the pun. Very good. At the at the next games in 1972, I'm pretty sure this one won't make the 72 podcast because 28 of the 40 competitors used Fosbury's technique, although none of them won gold. Yuri Tarmac used the old straddle technique to win. However, in the women's event, Ulrika Mayfarth did win gold using Fosbury's technique. So Mayfarth, the first female athlete to win a gold with the flop, or maybe we should call it the other thing. Do you remember it, Ruth?
Something
the Brill Bend.
The Brill Bend. Yeah.
The Brill Bend.
The Brill Bend.
Yeah, what so that's the story of Dick.
What innovation would you like to see in 24? What is something that should be changed? An entire technique that no one has yet comprehended, but which you envisage could happen. Could it be like, I don't know, people now swim on their sides? I don't know. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there, Chris. What is the new thing going to be? Do you win hurdles just by running really fast into them? What could be the new technique?
Wow. I mean, you're asking me, and people who are actively trying to win medals are not even thinking about this. So this can only go one way. Absolutely. I would like to see the German modern pentathlon team, in an act of solidarity after what happened in Tokyo, allow the horses to ride the athletes over the fences in the equestrian section of the competition. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it will result in victory, or maybe they will ride bikes over the fences. They will do something. Athletes riding on random people instead of random horses? People from the crowd?
Yeah.
Have we got modern pentathlon tickets, Ruth? Could it be us? If so, I'm ready. I'm ready to jump over some fences for a German modern pentathlete.
Yeah, Chris, they are all... Yeah,
that's where I think this is going.
They are all really good ideas. And I wonder if we went and had a look at the actual rules, do you have to be riding the horses? Like, is that... In the modern pentathlon, do you have to be astride the horse when you come to the jumps? And the issue has always been, hence why the coach punched a horse, in case people have forgotten that, It is.
Pretty sure we have a podcast about
we
that.
We do, yeah.
That incident
we do.
Back in the archives.
Back in the archives. On our day, when we were so disciplined that we recorded daily podcasts. But yeah, no, I think you're really onto something. That is going to be where the next innovation is. Now, unfortunately for the modern pentathlon, all the rules are changing anyway. So they would want to really get onto it.
May as well go out with a bang.
Exactly. Yeah. I like the idea of the horses riding them because that takes out the kind of randomness of it in a sense.
Yeah.
You are relying on the horses being good at riding you, I suppose. But I feel like you can control that more.
Maybe. Do you have something in mind?
No, I had nothing. I just threw it out.
Testing it. Yeah. I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah, no, that was good.
Given the test I was throwing. Where should we go next, Ruth? What do you got for us?
Oh, there was also, wasn't there? No, you're going to have to correct me here because these are year-old notes. Was it triple jump or long jump that we had?
Bob.
Yeah.
Bob Beeman.
Yeah.
Yeah, long jump.
Long jump, yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah, so in the long jump, sticking with the athletics, Bob Beeman breaks barriers. He set a new record, 27 feet, 4¾ inches, or 8.34 meters. He had 22 wins in 23 meets coming into the games, but he did not sail through the qualies. His first two jumps resulted in fouls. His teammate, Ralph Boston, who had got the gold in Rome and silver in Tokyo, told him, "Bob, you won't foul if you take off a foot behind the foul line. You can't miss." Echoing the words of Germany's Lutz Long to Jesse Owens during Berlin 36. So that's what he did.
Ah.
Yeah, so that's what he did. He just made sure that he jumped really far behind the foul line and he was okay. The previous record had been 27 feet, 4¾ inches, or 8.34 meters. So he then jumped 29 feet, 2.5 inches, or 8.9 meters. That's a pretty big, that, like, and considering the fact that he was jumping behind the foul line by a bit, you know.
I know that was in the qualification, but
that
then
was
I think
qualification.
He,
okay.
He, yeah. No, but then the next day he did break the world record.
Yeah.
I think I hope for everyone else's sake. I know I'm pretty sure he got closer to the board there, because. And it's funny because I mentioned the metric system before that you were battling through those distances. He beat the existing record at the time by 55 centimeters,
mm-hmm.
Or 21¾ inches.
Nearly
and,
two rulers.
Because of his unfamiliarity with the metric measurements, he didn't realize what he'd actually achieved and that, like, the huge amount he smashed the record by, and which was by nearly 2 feet. When he was told by his teammate and coach, Ralph Boston, his legs gave way and an astonished and overwhelmed Beeman suffered a brief cataplexy attack brought on by the emotional shock. But yeah, he did well. Not only did he do well, Ruth.
Okay.
So yeah, he absolutely destroyed the event. And before that world record, it had been broken 13 times since 1901,
mm-hmm.
With a pretty steady increase every time. He held the record for 23 years and it's still the second longest jump of all time.
It's pretty good. It's pretty
that
good.
Is absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was known as the man who saw lightning that day. And as we love athletes who did a little bit of a crossover afterwards or were multi-talented, he was drafted by the Phoenix Suns, the NBA basketball team, in the 15th round of the following year's NBA draft, but never played an NBA game.
Dublin Zoo used to have... Go on.
He just turned 22 when he did that, by the way. Dublin Zoo?
So Dublin Zoo used to have a long jump, and it used to have, like, this is how far a tortoise can jump. This is how far a rabbit can jump. And this is how far a man can jump. And this is how far. I can't remember, but like, I think it was something like a leopard or a cheetah.
And there was one for Bob Beeman?
Yeah, then, like, I mean, I assume, like, that's the mark they used. But yeah, animals do really well. They do really well. They can do. I mean, okay, I'm going to be honest. Like, the tortoise wasn't going to be able to do much at this event. But, like, there's some animals that can really push us in our place.
Oh, undoubtedly. George Foreman.
He grills
what
good.
What does that name say to you?
Oh, sorry. I preempted that. But yes, certainly during the noughties and the 90s, he was the foremost of mother's dieting plans.
Yes, he was. The old lean, mean, fat-reducing grilling machine launched in 1994. However, an entire 26 years before that, he won gold medal in the heavyweight boxing division by defeating the Soviet Union's Jonas Chepulis via second-round knockout. And I'm pretty sure in the last couple of Olympic pods we've had a good row of really famous boxers win the heavyweight championship. We had Muhammad Ali, we had Joe Frazier, and now we have George Foreman. He was only 19 at the time, and looking to keep the American gold trail going. Smoking Joe Frazier had turned his Olympic success from 4 years ago into professional dominance. And so next up was George. And I just got to read this little paragraph that's quoting him and has nothing to do with winning the title. It's more what happened afterwards. As we know, the actual sport doesn't really matter. I went home and wore the gold off that medal. It was 1968, and it fit really well with my Nehru jacket. That was in style. I proudly walked down Lyons Avenue in the Fifth Ward in Houston. This is, wearing my medal. A guy I thought was a friend walked up to me, looked me in the face, and said, "How could you do what you did when the brothers, this is Smith and Carlos, were doing their thing?" He said, "It broke my heart." And what he did, he just, all he did was wave a small American flag and bow to the crowd after winning the title, which feels pretty darn harsh to say. But that didn't stop George. He also turned professional, so he's just 20 at this time. And then he won the World Heavyweight title in 1973 with, again, a second round knockout. Something about these second round knockouts for George Foreman, beating the then undefeated and the previous Olympic gold medalist, Joe Frazier, in 1973. He finally suffered his first professional loss to another previous Olympic gold medalist, Muhammad Ali, in the iconic Rumble in the Jungle in 1974. But Ruth, as you mentioned at the top of this bit, that's not what he's really known for, is it?
No, no.
Following what he referred to as a religious epiphany, Foreman became
go on.
No, this is still leading up to what he's actually known for. He launched the lean, mean, fat reducing grilling machine. I did that on purpose though. I'm sorry. I led you astray, Ruth. I'm sorry. He did have a religious epiphany. He became an ordained Christian minister. And 10 years after his epiphany, 1994, so this is 20 years after he lost the Rumble in the Jungle, age 45, he made a comeback and won the unified heavyweight titles. So won all the heavyweight titles in one go. 1994, Ruth, that was when he won the titles, and that is when he also launched his true destiny. The lean, mean, fat-reducing grilling machine.
Who do you think from 2021 Tokyo is going to release their iconic air fryers? I mean, surely air fryers is where it's going to go.
Oh, yeah. Air fryer. Maybe, I think either, it's going to be one of the Scandies. I reckon Carsten Warholm or Mondo Duplantis. They're probably two.
Yeah, it's Duplantis.
Duplantis, yeah. Maybe his plant-based... He'll have some kind of plant-based thing. Duplantis to save the mondo, to save the world. That'll be his invention.
Yeah. If his manager
and it writes itself, right?
Yeah, if he wants to get in touch, we will take that sponsor. Mm-hmm. We will also help the concept of whatever it is he is going to eventually sell. But yeah, get in touch with us.
I like it. Okay.
We've been very, very, well, sorry, we have just been talking about boxing. But like, we haven't even talked once about pictograms or the imagery.
And we've been recording for 55 minutes and I have to leave in 15 minutes. So what do we got?
So many, many months ago, Chris, we watched the official Olympic film for 1968. And as the kids would say, the fashion was fire. The official logo very much lent itself to the creation of some very groovy, slightly migraine-inducing fabric patterns, which were all on display at the 1968 Mexico Olympics fashion show, which we saw, Chris, in the film.
We did indeed. Yeah, the abstract design, which was used, like the logo, was an Aztec temple in bright and bold colors. It was designed by an American.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was like an open call for it, and then he won this open call, and he drew inspiration from traditional Mexican patterns and imagery. I think after he was asked to come, he and a colleague spent a load of time in Mexico and just kind of got down to it, got their inspiration, and then bingo bango, job's a good one. And it wasn't just the logo, but there was a wide range of the graphic elements. There was a poster, signage, uniforms that all incorporated the bold colors, the geometric designs, and cultural references as well. Even if I don't remember incorrectly, they use it like also in the signage,
mm-hmm,
and public transport to help people get around, which was quite important. Not everyone at the time, and not everyone now, speaks Spanish. So they had all this pre-Hispanic imagery and iconography, which was also on the official merchandise. And yeah, I think it was a big achievement artistically, and also the integration of the culture. And it helped to establish Mexico as a kind of leading center in design and creativity as well, mm-hmm, after that.
I personally think it is in the top 10 of logos, Mexico 68.
I might even put it higher, but I am not in a position right now to challenge that and say where exactly it would be. But that's something.
I'm not saying it's not number one. I'm just saying it is in the top 10. So it could be number one.
That's a safe bet. I mean, that is.
Yeah.
I'm not. I expect more bold takes than that from you. Come on.
The fashion show looked great. I'm just going to throw into this that the notes that we did take 10 months ago, after watching the film, is my notes were pigeons, lots of bums, football. I don't know what it refers to, Chris. I think at one point in the film that we watched, a lot of pigeons got released. I don't know. But I'm just going to put that out for the listeners. They can watch the film and they can get back to us at... What's our email address? Olympopod@gmail.com?
Yeah. Simple as that.
You can get back to us. You watch that film and you tell us what those notes refer to. Or
send us a message on Twitter or...
Yeah. Or Instagram. That's probably where we're going to be at.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, you're running low on time, which is... Which you mean.
I am.
But what I will say is that something happened at this Games, which I would have a lot of sympathy for.
Okay.
Because, as I mentioned at the head of this, I am actually coming into this Games, this Olympopod, with an injury, carrying an injury. I slipped on ice and I hurt my knee. But, such is my commitment to the Olympic spirit, I am continuing on with this recording. And someone who would really support that decision would be John Stephen Aquari, who finished last in the Olympic marathon with a dislocated knee.
Oy.
Which,
how? Why? What?
I, when asked, you know, like he came in obviously quite further behind than the other runners. And he was asked by journalists, you know, why did he keep running? And he said, well, my country did not send me 5,000 miles to start the race. They sent me 5,000 miles to finish the race.
Yeah, that's nice. And he did.
Yeah.
And he did. And he finished the race in front of a packed crowd, which you might be a little bit surprised by, given that the marathon had finished, the leader had finished an hour before that, the medals had already been given out. However, thankfully for Akwari, the crowd, so enamored and taken in by the four-hour high jump competition happening at the same time, previously mentioned. So much so that they actually didn't, apparently, they didn't actually really pay much attention to when the winner came in. But when Akwari, all alone, an hour later came in, people noticed. So he also has a little bit of Dick Fosbury to thank for making it such a big story. But, I mean, for a guy to hobble along like that after a dislocated knee. Oh God. It's remarkable.
I think I'd just stop.
Ah, well.
And look, I know you say to me, but Ruth, you're coming here with an injury and you're recording this podcast. And you're right. You're right. Like, I mean, I could have just sat this one out and I didn't. I came in with my knee injury and I have been playing an absolute blinder, not even coming in last.
My country sent me 5 meters to record and not to just start the podcast. They sent me 5 meters to finish the podcast. And finish we shall soon.
Yeah.
And
finish we shall soon. But I'm going to just start a beef here.
Go on,
Chris.
Go on.
And I've lost my exact notes on this, but I'm going to go with it. Jeff Tibbles, who we have mentioned constantly in this podcast. He's been a Ruth and Chris favourite. He has written on the most bizarre tales of the Olympics. He doesn't seem to have any presence at all, other than this one book he wrote about Olympic stories. But we're a great fan. And we've come across some great stories in it. And we have gone and we have found other references to them. But I was reading his account of Akwari winning. Mm-hmm. And he gives the quote
last.
That finishing finishing last. And he gives...
winning. Winning last.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, winning his right to Olympic history. And he gives the quote of, my country didn't send me 7,000 miles. And what is this? I have now looked this up in several different sources. He said 5,000. Why is Jeff adding 2,000 miles to this? And look, Chris, I've had a look into it. It's not about kilometres or anything like that. He said 7,000 miles.
Okay.
Tell me what's going on, Chris. What is Jeff doing to us? Do we have to now re-record all previous Olympopods where we reference Jeff Tibbles? Is he an unreliable source? I mean, we have no idea who he is, but like, he's been an iconic figure in this Olympopod.
Ruth, could it be that the quote doesn't really matter because he was wrong anyway? The distance between Tanzania and Mexico City is 14,942 kilometers, which is 9,284.5 miles.
I mean, now what do we do? Is this Olympopod invalid? Like, are we, what, or is this only valid commentary that has ever taken place on these events?
Yeah, but either way, like, it doesn't matter what he's being quoted as, because both quotes are factually inaccurate, mm-hmm. but the spirit of his point remains in place. And now it makes me think, why 5,000? Just because it sounded good? A bit like the Proclaimers song saying, I would run 500, not 5,000, but 500 miles. And I would run 500 more just to be the man who, all that other words. No, there's no time for the Proclaimers here, Ruth. We have some other shout outs to give. I've got some shout outs to give because there are many, many good stories which we've covered here, but some other athletes who stood out here.
Mm-hmm.
Wyoming Matthias She became the first person to retain the Olympic title in the 100 meters for women. Willy Holdorf has the best name of the championship. A German discus thrower who won a gold medal. He was the first German to win the discus throw for men, which feels a little bit surprising. Vera Chaslavska, Czech gymnast, who won 4 gold medals and 2 silvers, including the all-round title, one of the greatest of all times. We didn't get into the gymnastics this time, but just we wait until 1972. Mm-hmm. Al Orter, Ruth, our friend Al Orter, he got his 4th consecutive gold medal. We've talked a lot about him in previous podcasts, so he didn't need a whole section this time. And yeah, that's just a few of the outstanding athletes.
And one final shout out from me too, Chris. Kipchoge Kipkaino collapsed onto the infield during the 10,000 meter track event with an undiagnosed bladder infection. He was attended to by stretcher bearing medics, but he refused the stretcher, got back up and finished the race. Although, has to be said, he was disqualified. But then, Chris, 4 days later, he took the silver in the 5,000 meters. 3 days after the silver, he was up in the 1,500 meter race, but he was stuck in traffic on the way there and had to jog the last mile to the stadium. Didn't do him any harm, Chris. He took gold with 20 meters to spare.
That's what a warm up. I mean, there's nothing that drives a person more than anger at traffic. And combined with the perfect distance for a warm-up for the 1,500 meters, I mean, there you go.
Yeah.
Nothing would stop him. That's a form of doping I can live with.
Yeah. Ireland sent 31 competitors to the Olympics, and Denmark got 8 medals. So there we go.
Come saw Denmark.
Yeah. So I'm going to be honest, a lot in the cycling. Including one that we'll hear about again in 72.
Nice. So, do you want to wrap us up there, Ruth, and give us a little taster of what's to come for your favourite Olympic Games of all time?
Well, it's not necessarily my favourite, Chris.
Until the next one.
It's just one that I am really well prepared for. It's just one I'm really well prepared for. And I will be talking about Colombian political scandals during the COVID era. I will be talking about Mongolian drugs. And yeah, like, it's 72 is going to be on fire, Chris. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to that record, which we're going to record in 2 days' time.
Woo! Lovely. Thank you all for your patience.
No! No, it's not about their patience. We did this. This is us.
Yes.
We do apologize. Okay. We are back. Aren't we, Chris? We're back. Yeah, we're back. It's the Olympics. 2024.
Nice.